Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Face-to-face. I don't get the opportunity to look them in the eye or to shake their hands. And my next guest was joining me from L.A., Shimon Dotan, and his new movie, The Settlers. This is a great, important, beautiful film. You need to see this for a variety of reasons, and I do hope that you check out our conversation. We talk about documentary cinema and the power that it has to reveal. How it's an exercise in listening. We talk about the West Bank and about Israel. We talk about conflict. We talk about ideology and religion and the separation, you know, of religion and state. We really do get into a whole lot of things here. Shimon talks about not being able to argue with somebody who believes that the Bible is a political contract. I mean, how interesting is that? So please stay tuned for our next conversation coming right up. And don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my podcasting. Also, you can help support what I do through patreon.com. And don't forget rabble.ca for more interviews as well. Please join us now for Shimon Dotan as we talk about his film, The Settlers, here on Face to Face.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here with us today to talk about his new film, The Settlers. Shimon Dotan is here all the way from L.A., so a few hours behind us. Shimon, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. And I'm in L.A. only today. I'll be
back
on the East Coast tomorrow. Yeah.
Oh, you're only in L.A. today. Well, that's too bad. It's currently snowing here in Toronto. So.
Yeah.
And you'll be heading back to New York?
Yes, I'm here for the opening of The Settlers in L.A. I'll be back to New York tomorrow.
Before we dig into the film, and I can't wait to chat about the film as a piece, as a documentary, about the issues that it raises and so on. Tell me a little bit about your career. You're a professor. You're a filmmaker. You're an activist. You've not only worked in documentary, but you've also worked in some Hollywood-like films as well, and have won many awards. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you find yourself where you are today.
I started in Romania. I was born in Romania, arrived to Israel at the age of 9 in 1959 with my family. Grew up in a moshav, which is a cooperative, agricultural cooperative. After serving in the Israeli military, I studied film and philosophy at Tel Aviv University. Did a few movies in Israel, one of them called Repeat Dive, which I think did play in Montreal and Toronto. The other is called The Smile of the Lamb, based on the first novel by David Grossman. And at some point, I joined my wife, which grew up in the U.S. and in Canada. She was born in Montreal.
Mm.
And I tried to explore the other side of the ocean. How do they make films?
Right.
It took some time to figure out that it's different than I thought that I expected.
Right.
But nevertheless, I made a few films. I started making a film in Los Angeles, an action film. I drew in good part on my personal experiences as a Navy SEAL in the Israeli military.
Right.
And I spent time in Montreal. I did a few movies there. I taught at Concordia University. And now I'm in New York, where I teach at NYU, and I mostly make movies. Now, you're right in saying that most of my work is fiction, narrative films. And in recent years, I did two documentaries, The Settlers being the second.
Mm.
The first one was called Hot House, that dealt with the Israeli jails and the prisoner inmates that are spending their multiple life sentences to start with. The film was screened, among other places, at CBC in Canada. And that's it.
So as a storyteller, I mean, because I would imagine that's primarily what you are, professor, filmmaker, storyteller, you've made two documentaries, you've made mostly narrative fiction films. Where do you find the most truth?
The jury's still out. We are in a search for this. You know, you should find the truth in both. You should find the truth everywhere. And it's not really where you find it, it's how do you approach it. And I hope, I do not say that I'm always abiding by that, but I'm trying to draw the substance of the topics that I'm touching. And if I did now The Settlers, so the film before that, the documentary, Hot House, I'm trying to understand the side of the individuals of the world that they occupy and the forces that shape them in a way that do not seem to be evident on the surface. And I know that film is a visual medium, and I'm trying to dig or to get the essence under the surface, but actually that seems to provide an interesting tension between what you see and what you know, or what you think, what you feel. But I just say, I'm really drawn to documentaries. I find great joy in making documentaries. They provide often a surprise element that is less present in a scripted narrative film. Late in my career, I do documentaries, and it's wonderful. I really enjoy it very much.
I guess, Ramon, I guess there's a lot more room for surprises in documentaries. I mean, you've got a structure for a film. You've got the fiction, the fictional narrative. You've got your storyboarding and so on. There's not I would imagine there's some room for creativity and growth on set and so on. But in a doc, the story kind of unfolds in front of you, doesn't it?
Yes, in the story, but more than the story, the individual that is in front of you.
Mm.
And, you know, I often come prepared. I learn as much as I can about the people that I meet. But there is always something surprising. There is always something, not always, but when it's good, it's surprising.
Right.
You get an angle that you do not expect. You learn something. And it's an encounter with a real individual, not with a scripted individual. But again, I'm not trying to take away from narrative films.
Right.
That's
right.
A great medium. But because somehow documentaries were, until, I don't know, a decade or two later, as a less developed brother of this wonderful medium of cinema, I think that it's remarkable. And, you know, I go back often to Dziga Vertov, that is considered the father of documentary cinema. And what's remarkable that he discovered in the early 20s, as a part of this new Russian cinema, most of the traits, most of the qualities of documentary filmmaking. So I don't know if you are familiar with his work, but probably many of those who are into filmmaking, into documentaries, recognized this Russian pioneer as the father of documentary cinema. He's not only recognized the power of the camera to reveal things that the narrative literature does not get to, but he deals with the medium itself. He makes the camera a part of his documentary narrative. So, anyway, yes, in favor of documentaries. I've been on both sides, and I can say with clear conscience the documentary is as wonderful as any other film.
Ironic in a way that the father of documentary cinema comes out of Russia, isn't it?
Well, yes, at the time when Pravda was starting, Pravda was probably started at that time. And Lenin was a great admirer of the medium because he recognized immediately the tremendous power of the medium to impact audiences.
Power for propaganda, yeah. No doubt.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what the case, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Which, yeah, ironic that Stanislav would be looking to reveal, looking to tell the truth, not to subvert, not to cover up.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you tell your students that filmmaking is about, I don't know, creating a space for empathy in the viewer? I mean, is that really, as we move into starting to talk a little bit more about The Settlers, and congratulations, by the way, on a remarkable film.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, everyone needs to see this film. I mean, this is the kind of, I think, filmmaking that's not only brilliant on one hand, but it's important as well on another, if that makes sense. But yeah, is this about empathy? Is that what you tell your students?
Well, I do tell students, I'd say, that especially documentary filmmaking is an exercise in listening, is an exercise in opening up for the other. I don't have much appreciation to documentaries that are preaching to acquire, even though they do have room. But I'm not here to make a political statement with my film. I'm here to genuinely listen to those who I'm in deep disagreement with.
Right.
And in the process, I believe that I learn, I grow, I expand my world. And in extension, I hope that same happens with my viewers, those who agree with me and those who disagree with me. But I'd say one more thing. What I find exciting is that every representation, even a documentary like The Settlers or anyone, it tells a lot about the person who makes the representation. So we can learn a lot about the entity behind the film, and not only about what is in the film. And I hope, I believe that viewers can educate themselves to try to identify where is the filmmaker, what drives him to do things this way or another, etc. It's a complex and very rich domain, which we should dive into it and take the most out of it, because really there is a lot there.
The Hollywood Reporter has said, quote, former Israeli Navy SEAL and filmmaker Shimon Dotan has delivered a ticking encapsulation of the never-ending conflicts revolving around the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Controversial before it was even filmed, this comprehensive examination of these settlement communities which sprang up after the 67 Six-Day War and now are home to hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers amid a Palestinian population is certain to ignite spirited debate, close quote. You're about to screen the film in L.A. It's screened at Sundance and NYU and others. Is it igniting spirited debate? Is it as controversial as you thought it was going to be, Shimon? I'm sure the whole process itself of writing, of shooting, of the people that you've met along the way has been an incredible process of discovery for you, I would imagine, and the people involved. But what about the controversy? What about the debate? What about the conflict?
Controversial it is, indeed. But I must say, to some degree, less than I expected. And maybe I'll try to share with you the way that I was the thinking process that I was engaged while making the film. I am very much against the settlement enterprise. I think that it's detrimental to the state of Israel, and I think that it evolved in an uncalculated way by the governments of Israel from the very beginning, from 1967 until today. They either surrounded to pressures on the ground, tried to gain immediate political benefits, etc. But it has never been a national project. It has never been a result of an educated analysis that resulted in the conclusion that, yes, settlements in the West Bank will benefit the state of Israel.
Right.
And we see the result today. Israel is in a dead end with this reality. However, when I worked on the film, I thought to myself, and that's a comment that I just made a few minutes ago, that there is no point in me making a political statement.
Right.
I can just write a blog, or I can write an essay and in a newspaper and express my political opinion. That does not justify a film, in my view. What I thought I will do, and that somehow corresponds with my way of thinking, with my curiosity, is to understand those who I disagree with, to get close to them, to try to get into their minds, into their houses, and to identify the humanity in them. And we know that every individual, even though he is a sum of his actions, but there are many elements that construct him, that drive him. And no one was born X, Y, or Z. People grow to be who they are.
Right.
And when I started working on the film, I made it very clear to everyone that I spoke with, that among the settlers, that I am a great opponent of their work, of their life. I told them what I think about the settlements, and to my pleasant surprise, most of them were willing to talk to me.
Hmm.
Even more so, that became a conversation which I think become richer by making it clear that I'm coming from the opposite side than if I would try to somehow either steal an interview or be vague about my personal position.
So, Shimon, am I correct to say then, so when you went in and you presented yourself to the opposing side, to the other, as it were, in this discussion and argument, you were very clear that this is who I am, this is where I stand. Will you be a part of my film? Will you be a part of this story?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
I genuinely believe that that's the way. Well, that's the way for me, and
right.
I think it's a way that yields results, because people do like and seek to engage.
Yes.
And if you are starting, if you approach them with that attitude, people like to tell their story. They like to prove you wrong or to agree with you. And that became in a way, I would say we entered into some kind of relationship. And because of that, I hope that what comes to the screen is something revealing. It's not the veneer that people put forward in order to shield themselves, but it gave us an opportunity to really jump to the other side of this veneer and get into the mind, into the way of that people think about their actions, their presence in the world, etc. So I hope that it comes onto the screen properly.
Well, it plays in my opinion, it plays in a very beautiful and engaging and kind of a resonant way. And it's the kind of film, I think, that the way you've juxtaposed some of the what I would call almost the more racist elements, or the more almost difficult elements to watch in the film, are going to stick with me without a doubt. I don't know how they can't not. I think one of the things for me about any conflict like this, being a Canadian coming from Toronto, having spent a lot of time overseas, a lot of time working in different cultures, I'm always astounded at the hatred, at the anger, at the demonization of others, whoever they might be, you know, our neighbors, our friends, our families, how quickly we are to turn. And so there's a sense in which I watch this film and I'm again reminded about how old this conflict really is. You know, we've got
I fully agree with you. And it's, you know, one of the first instincts in when a conflict emerges is polarization, is to draw the black and white line.
Yeah, black and white. It makes it easier, right?
You're right. Not only easier, it's almost a necessity. In order to really engage efficiently in a violent conflict, you need to really have, to demonize the other. However, if you are trying to defuse a conflict, I think that the first thing that you have to do is to take away this black and white portrayal of the world and try to get to the more nuanced reality that is actually just in front of you. So I think that it's our responsibility, almost our duty, to identify other sides in those who are opposing and try to somehow to bring it to the surface. And of course, it's true on a personal level, but I think it's true on a national level as well. And politics is often too much of a black and white, this binary reality, which it does not serve us well in many instances.
Doesn't so much of religion fall into that black and white category as well? I mean,
that's a big one.
I want to ask you: is this a religious? Is this really a religious problem? Is it, or is it more of a revenge problem? I mean, I know it's not it's not either or. It's not black or white. It's far more nuanced and complicated and paradoxical. But still, you know, you get into conversation, or the two of us are in conversation, and I'm frustrated already because I want a solution, Shimon. Right? After watching your film, I walk away saying, for crying out loud, why can't we, you know, begin to get in the room together, you know, and have this conversation? And what I think's beautiful about your film, by the way, is that it sounds to me like that conversation is starting and things are moving.
I don't think. I don't think that one film can make the change. But it's one film and another film, and it's
part of the bigger story.
And that, of course, we are all participating in a big cultural evolutional process. And I do believe. Fact is that things in the world do change.
Yes.
It's never a one man doing. It's a result of a common will of people that express common view. So I do think it's just, you know, it's a brick in the building that we hope to do. It's never one element alone. But you made before, David, a point which I find crucial. And you talk about religion.
Yes, yes.
And if religion is the core of the conflict or not. Well, it's complicated. But it could have been simple. That conflict at its core is territorial. There is no more than that. There are two people who are fighting on the same territory. And I think the territory can be divided. Mm. And often territory is divided.
Mm-hmm.
However, with the settlement enterprise, what happened is the major forces that drove the settlement enterprise at its inception, first month, years after 1967, were ideological and religion in nature. And because of that, it evoked a religious response from the other side. I'm not saying that the other side, the Palestinians or the Muslims in the region, were not religiously driven. But that was not the core of the conflict. The core was territorial.
Right.
However, once it became a religious conflict, two things happened, and both of them are terribly dangerous and detrimental to any chance to achieve peace. On one hand, from a conflict that can be resolved, it became absolute. Because land you can divide, the water you can share, you know, all these things. But religion, sanctity, you cannot divide.
Right.
So it became an absolute. And it became an absolute in the hands of politicians. And that's the moment when religion infiltrated politics. And when the politics are tainted with religion, you cannot compromise. And you could see too often in the region that Yitzhak Rabin was willing to compromise, but because he was tainted as the man who gives away holy land, he was assassinated.
Right.
He was killed. And the whole history in the region changed. The first immediate impact is that it's absolutized. No, there is not such a word. But give your English.
No, it's good. I'm okay with creating new words, so go right ahead.
So it makes the conflict absolute.
Yes.
Meaning it's irresolvable. On the other hand, which is even a bigger problem, the conflict ceased to be a local, regional conflict. It became a world conflict. It became all the Jews in the world against all the Muslims in the world,
right,
or the other way around.
Right.
And when that happens, you know, the terrors are terrible.
It's become a global conflict, right?
It's global territory. It's become global, yes.
Still territorial, but globally territorial.
Well, it's global. So in my view, the core of the problem at present time is the lack of separation between religion and state.
Hmm.
And if Israel will not be inspired to make this separation, I'm afraid that we are not going to see favorable times ahead of us. And, you know, Zionism started as a secular enterprise with one and only one goal, is to provide safe haven to persecuted Jews.
Hmm.
That was Herzl's idea. That's what drove him to start modern Zionism. And he was seeking a land, a state that will be recognized by the nations of the world and will host Jews, will be the home for the Jews in the world. And he always was talking about the democracy. And for that, we need to keep the state that has a democratic Jewish population. And as such, it can call itself Jewish. If it loses its Jewish majority, it will be something else, which, you know, without speculating too much, that was not the purpose of the inception of the State of Israel. And what we have today is that religion took over in a way that completely turned upside down the forces that drove the State of Israel to come into being.
Shimon, how do you have a discussion, and you clearly were able to do it as a filmmaker and someone who was clearly invested in this dialogue and this conflict in a variety of ways. But, you know, one of the rabbis, I believe, that you talked to in the film said, quote, we saw it as a divine, or we see it as a divine calling.
Yes.
How do you have a conversation with someone who has divine revelation up their sleeve?
Yes.
Or on their side? And I just, coming out of, you know, my own tradition of philosophy academically, for me, you know, it's about, you know, Socratic dialogue. It's about the dialectic. It's about back and forth until we can say, you know what? Aha, now I get it. I see what you're saying. But if I've got divine authority on my side, if I'm this absolutist, as you say, there's no room, or there's very little room, it seems to me.
Yeah. You're right, and maybe that's one of the reasons that I try not to go there, because the dialogue ends the moment that justification becomes it's written in the Bible or divine intervention.
You have that. Sorry, Shimon, I have to interrupt you. You have that great, beautiful scene in the film, tragically beautiful scene in the film, where the young woman is sitting on the rocks, looking out over the olive trees. And you ask a question, and she said, "Well, we don't tend to these olive trees, you know, that the Palestinians do." And you say, "Who decided that?" "Well, God decided."
I ask her. She says that this is our land. She says, "Who said this is?" So God, she says, "God said. God said this is our land." I ask her, "God said that the land between the settlement of Esh Kodesh and the village of Jalud belongs to you, to the Jews?" Says, "It's written in the Bible." Now, you cannot argue with individuals who believe that the Bible is a contract, is a political document to be implemented. As I said before, that's not Zionism. Zionism is a plight to provide safe haven to persecuted Jews. And the State of Israel is a liberal, democratic state that is there to find a place for Jews to express explore their identity, to do good in the world, and to engage in what is called in Hebrew tikkun olam, that to benefit the world. And it's not an expansionist ideology, and it's not an overpowering ideology. And the tragedy of a great military victory is that infuses a foreign element into an idea which was pure and humane at its core. Mm. And with your background in philosophy, I'm sure that it's not new to you to understand that great military victories are often the first step towards a terrible disaster. Mm. I think we have to find a way to go back to the roots of Zionism, and not only that, but to understand that the conflict, we cannot allow the conflict to become a religious one.
To what degree would you say it's become so muddied, the waters have become so muddied? I've read several reviews on the film, talked about how, you know, from a settler's perspective, it's not just about territory, it's not just about religion or revenge, but it actually might just be a little bit about real estate. And there's got to be, of 500,000 or so people, there have to be just families who are just trying to get by and trying to live their lives, right? This isn't a political statement for them. This is,
of course,
you know,
you're
I've got three kids, and I want them to have an education, and I need a good job, and right? I love my friends and family.
You are absolutely right, and actually, the numbers are, I'm sure, surprising to many. Just to go back to the figures, there are about 420,000 Israeli settlers living in the West Bank today. Mm. About 80% of them, not less, are there for economical reasons.
Right.
They are there for housing, or better the quality of life. Only 20% of those settlers are ideologically and religiously driven. And the reason to that is that Israel provided housing in the West Bank and less so in Israel proper. And, as much as we try to be political and absolutists, you cannot blame a family that cannot find the proper housing in Israel.
Of course not.
And they are offered better housing not too far into the West Bank. And this whole, the territory, it's very small, from Tel Aviv to Ariel, which is a city in the heart of the West Bank, maximum half an hour drive. Half an hour.
Wow.
You get to downtown Toronto to, I don't know, a suburb in much more time than that.
Yes, yes.
And most of the people are preoccupied with their life, with their providing for their family, etc. And many of our, Torontonians or Tel Avivians are not so much concerned with politics and with the ideas or idealism, but to provide for their families. Yeah.
Well, isn't this, I mean, okay, so let's go idealistic here for a second. Let's go really hopeful. Isn't this a place to find some kind of common ground?
I don't know. I tell you why. Because once somebody gets a good house or proper housing, and some are getting more than a good house and beautiful views. And Judea and Samaria are just wonderful, wonderful pieces of land. And I try, by the way, to make it a player in the film. But once that happens, people will be reluctant to give it away.
Right.
But even if they're not there for ideological reasons, but believe me, economic reasons are very strong ideology.
Sure, of course.
So therefore... But I want to say on the positive side that about, 80% of the settlers live in close proximity to the Green Line. And it's one of the agreements, the potential agreements that's on the table, is that through a land swap, Israel can keep 80% of the settlers where they are today and still releasing enough territory for the Palestinians to have a state of their own.
You know, I've got a kind of a bigger question for you, and it's very specific to what's going on here in this part of the world, but I think it relates, and especially with my background in development, international development in particular, the whole idea of going into another community you know, as a white Western development worker is deeply problematic on a variety of levels, and can cause all kinds of problems, you know, of context and culture and or lack of cross-cultural sensitivity and so on. You know, somebody in the film says, you know, this is a, I believe, a, my paraphrase here, but it was this is a European problem or a European concept. The homeland, I believe. You know, the UN partition. Yeah. The UN partition in 1947. You know, what right did they have? You know, to actually impose those kinds of things. So I guess my question is, Ron, and it's a biggie. If other cultures had stayed out of this, would we be in the place we're in today? Does that make sense? I mean, again, I know it's kind of an either or sort of polarized question and presupposes a whole lot. But I just wonder to what degree, you know, the American involvement, the Syrian involvement, the Egyptian involvement, and so on and so on. Where do you land on that?
You know, it's hard to compare cultures, societies, nations.
Yes, yes.
The Americans had a very simple way to resolve the Indian problem. And that's quite terrible.
Mm.
And I don't think, not I don't think, I know, the 2.8 Palestinians who live in the West Bank are not going anywhere. They are there to stay.
Right.
And Israel does recognize that, but only half-heartedly.
Interesting.
It recognizes it because the last 3 decades or so, Israel is governed by right-wing governments that actually are great proponents of the settlement, yet none of those governments dare to annex the West Bank or territories of it. So there is a recognition that this is not a simple solution to annex it. The alternative to keep living there and creating disturbed separation between two people, between the Israelis or Jews and the Palestinians, is not sustainable. We have a disparity of 1 to 20 in the income between the Jews and the Palestinians in this region.
Wow.
So all these are factors that are calling for a resolution, not as, as something that will be good only for the Palestinians, but it's a necessity for the Israelis as well. And so when you ask about what would have happened or what could be different, it's really a very small piece of land, but we are doomed to live with our Palestinian neighbors, and they are doomed to live with us. And we have to resolve it. And what, to my great the disappointment, that the current Israeli government does not genuinely try to resolve it. They are trying to maintain the status quo, and with the hope that some, I don't know, a divine intervention will bring solution. But as we know, divine intervention is busy somewhere else. It's not going to visit us anytime soon.
Before I want to ask you about one of the young men that you interview and his what appear to be deeply disturbing racist tendencies and inclinations in the film, and I want to ask you about that. Well, in fact, why don't we do that before we kind of we're going to have to wrap up here, sadly, in a few minutes, Shimon. I can't believe our conversation is coming to an end. But there's this young man that you interview, and he says 8 or 9 times in the context of what a 45-second answer, he's a racist.
Yes,
and I won't do all these things to help anyone else because I'm a racist. Any Arabs, any Muslims. Is that fairly common? I mean, you say
no.
80% are settlers who are there for economic reasons, 20% are there
course.
For ideological, but that's got to be pretty extreme, doesn't it?
That's extremely extreme.
Okay.
Let me just say that the vast majority of the settlers in the West Bank are not extremists. They are just, you know, people that are a reflection, a mirror view of the population of Israel. And they, as we said a few minutes ago, they are there to do well for themselves and their family, and they are not racist and they are not extremists. However, the settlement enterprise at its inception and through its evolution was driven by the extremists.
Mm.
So therefore, I focus in the film in good part on the extremists. Now, this young man that declares himself being a racist, I was surprised and troubled to hear him saying that. Even more so, I was hesitant to include it in the film because this is not a sentiment that I heard often. I did hear it and I did see expressions of it, but it's marginal. However, the margins too often are driving this locomotive.
Right.
And
right.
Because of that, I thought that it would be important to include it.
It's as if you've unpacked this notion of ideological bullying, you know, and it's something I've never really sort of reflected on it in that sense before, and it's incredibly dangerous, as you say, without a doubt. Yeah. Good to hear though that it's more rare than not. Major General, he was a commander. Is it Shlomo Gezit? Is that how you pronounce
his name? Yes, exactly, Shlomo Gezit. Yes.
He says, I know that it can't go on this way. 85 years old, I imagine he's seen quite a bit.
Yeah, he was the first commander of the occupied territories. And he was the person on the ground. He saw it all.
He saw it all.
And he has this perspective of 50 years or so, from 1967 until today. And him, like many in his position, are absolutely keen of the absolute need of a resolution that will recognize the two-state solution.
And he says, let's wait. I mean, I guess he's probably a little tongue-in-cheek, but he says, let's wait another 500 years?
Yeah, no. I asked him, I told him that the Sedna Enterprise is much present and potent and just growing. And if it lasted for 50 years, why not for 500 years? And his response was, I'm 88 years old now. So you can say, if it lasted 88 years old, why not another 808 years?
Right.
And he says it's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable.
He doesn't know how it will change, but it will change. And we better be those who will initiate the change than having to face an unexpected change in the future.
Shimon, just before we wrap up, you still to me, and I don't want to put any words in your mouth here at all, and I don't think you'd let me anyway, but you sound hopeful. Is that fair? Is that a fair question? Fair comment?
That's absolutely precise comment. It's not that I'm hopeful. I am convinced, but at the same time, because I'm determined to preserve and keep and let the state of Israel evolve into what it was designed to be. And we cannot afford any other option. The project of Israel cannot fail. And I believe that there is enough positive energy, and there are many individuals in Israel and around the world that will not let that happen. And the fact that the dialogue about the settlement, the dialogue about the division between, or the infiltration of religion into state, for example, all that are a part of our immediate dialogue, are a testimony to that the help is in the way, let me put it this way.
Help is on the way.
On the way, yeah.
Well, I think, that's probably going to be too positive a note for some who are listening to this interview, but I think I'm going to end it there, and maybe we can do a part two together down in the future. I really appreciate the time. I'm genuinely thrilled that we were able to find the time to have this conversation, Shimon, to talk about your new film. The film is The Settlers. Shimon Dutan talking today about his new film. And what is the future of the film? So it's getting a wide release, or has already been released, has it not?
Yes, it's being released, as I mentioned, in New York, Los Angeles,
nice.
Toronto, Montreal. And it was screened in Europe quite largely. It had last summer in Israel a wide theatrical release. So the film gets quite a substantial attention, and I would say it's not the film, it's the topic, and I hope the topic through the lens of the film.
Well, I congratulations again, Shimon, on a beautiful, tragically beautiful film, and I trust that it will continue to create or ignite, as I think the Hollywood Reporter said, ignite spirited debate.
Thank you, David. You're very kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.